From the nation's capital, this is D.C. Public Safety. I'm your host, Leonard Sipes. Back in our microphones, Joe Russo. The program today is focusing on community corrections technology. Always a joy to have Joe back at our microphones. Joe is with the University of Denver. He currently serves as the Director of Corrections Technology Center of Excellence, a program within the National Law Enforcement and Corrections Technology Center. Joe, welcome back to D.C. Public Safety.
Hi, Len. Always a pleasure to be with you.
Always a pleasure to have you. You are by far, I think, one of our most popular shows that we've had in the past. So, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to be talking about a variety of issues today. Satellite tracking. We're going to be talking about drug and alcohol testing, leveraging video conferencing, which I find really exciting, officer safety developments, and social media, the development of a issue paper with the American Probation and Parole Association. Joe, let's start off with satellite tracking. What's happening there?
Well, I just want to make your audience aware that an NIJ, National Institute of Justice-funded project to develop standards for offender tracking systems is ongoing and approaching completion. This standard is the first of its kind and was designed by practitioners, practitioner-informed process to establish performance standards, robustness standards, safety and circumvention detection standards around these systems. These systems have been in existence for quite some time, and there is no industry standard for these devices. And so NIJ thought it was important, based on practitioner input, and created a project to develop these standards. And these are nearing completion in the near future. And the next step is we'll be evaluating some of the test methods that we've developed to make sure that they're efficient and effective and the most appropriate way to go about evaluating these tools and making sure that they're up to par for public safety use.
And we at the Court Services and Offender Supervision Agency, my agency here in Washington, D.C., we've been instrumental in developing those standards, correct?
Yes, and yes, in fact, Carlton Butler, who I believe recently retired from your agency, was one of the members of our special technical committee, and he was very, very instrumental in that process. Carlton was one of a number of community corrections professionals from across the country who came together regularly to discuss their needs around offender tracking technology, where the technology was lacking, and what standards should be in place to protect the public.
Now, the interesting thing is that, let me throw out a couple observations and tell me if I'm correct or incorrect. Satellite tracking, GPS satellite tracking is exploding within this country in terms of supervising people on supervision, right?
It's growing rapidly. I hesitate to agree that it's exploding. I think depending on who you talk to, certainly the vendors wouldn't say it's exploding, or else their bottom lines would be exploding as well. But it is growing. It is definitely growing. One of the key issues in this area, and one that the associations or government should take a look at, is really getting a good sense for the market, how many offenders are on tracking. It's very difficult to get that number. If you talk to experts from across the country, the best that they can give you are just estimates based on previous surveys, informal surveys. So that's something that I think that the field needs. But overall, when you compare it to the number of people who are on community supervision, it's a very small percentage. So, again, there are many ways to answer that question, whether it's growing, but it could be further utilized for sure.
But I'm thinking of two major research reports, one out of Florida and one out of California, that indicated dramatically lower rates of recidivism, dramatically lower rates of technical violations, and reduced rates of arrest while under supervision. So satellite tracking research, GPS research, seems to be promising.
Absolutely. As you say, both the Florida studies and the California studies show reductions in recidivism. I think that like any technology or like any program, things evolve and things are dynamic. And, these two studies should not be considered the be-all and end-all. I think there's still a lot of room for us as an industry, as a field, to grow academically, to understand better how GPS can best be applied to achieve the outcomes that we desire. For example, I don't believe either study took a look at how GPS performed with or without treatment services. Mm-hmm. And we might learn that, GPS providing lifestyle structure combined with treatment services where needed produces an even greater effect. Mm-hmm. So, the initial research has been very promising, and I think that further research is needed, and it can only probably be better applied in the future.
But a standard, as I understand it from most of the research done on community corrections, is that if there is a social services component, and I know that you could, you know, that's vague enough to drive a bus through. But if there's treatment involved along with the supervision package, it's been the treatment component of it that has been particularly successful in the past. So that's a good point. Satellite tracking combined with treatment, depending upon the quality of the treatment and the intensity of the treatment, could have some real implications for keeping people out of further activity and keeping them out of the prison system.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, it touches on issues, for example, in terms of dosage. What's the appropriate dosage of satellite tracking? Do people need to be on satellite tracking for extended lengths of time? Is there a point of diminishing returns? The more research we have, the more we understand, you know, the dynamics, the better we can apply that technology and get better outcomes at a better cost.
Now, the interesting thing is that I've read a draft copy of your report in terms of the development of the technology standard. It was pretty daggone comprehensive. It was large. It was very detailed, very technical. So this is the first time that GPS and satellite tracking has been examined by the Corrections Technology Center of Excellence under the National Law Enforcement and Corrections Technology Center system. I mean, this is the first time it really has been systematically examined in terms of how people use satellite tracking, GPS tracking, and possibly what are the best uses of satellite and GPS tracking.
Yes, and we deal quite a bit on that issue in what we call the Selection and Application Guide, which is designed to help agencies interpret the technical standard and use that information in their programs across the country. So the technical standard would speak more towards performance metrics of how the technology should work, and the Selection and Application Guide would, as you allude to, address more of the potential applications. You know, how is the technology used to address or to achieve the outcomes that are desired?
Is that available yet?
Drafts are available, but all of the documents that were produced, the standard, the Selection and Application Guide, were recently put out for public comment in January of this year, and they're all available.
All right, so they're still available for public comment.
The public comment period has concluded.
Okay.
But those drafts, I believe, are still on the web somewhere.
And how do they get them?
I would go to the NIJ website.
Okay, the National Institute of Justice website.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll have the link in our show notes regarding that. Okay, the efforts to promote information sharing. One, this is, I think, unique because now for the first time we've had literally hundreds of organizations around the United States and beyond, from what I understand, talking to each other in terms of how they use satellite tracking, what the pitfalls are, what the difficulties are, what the remedies are. And I think that's probably one of the biggest things that came out of your effort, the fact that now people are talking to each other.
Yeah, you know, the best way to learn is from your colleagues and from your colleagues' experiences, and the, you know, whatever networking can occur on that level is just tremendous. There's no sense reinventing the wheel. There's much we can learn from our colleagues, as you mentioned, across the country, across the world. National Institute of Justice has funded some specific projects to further information sharing of the data. That's pretty interesting. They're funded the development of information exchange packet documentation, which will allow for technically data from different systems to be integrated and shared so that it could be utilized more effectively.
Really?
Yeah. And this, again, came from recommendations from our practitioner groups. And they recommended that this be developed to address two major issues. And one is public safety, and the other is resource allocation. The public safety element comes into play and was illustrated very well in the recent case in Orange County, where you had two homeless sex offenders recently arrested for the murder of a prostitute. And as they found out, they had committed four murders over the course of time. Now, both offenders were tracked via GPS, They were supervised by different agencies, one by the federal U.S. Probation, the other by California Parole.
Oh, I remember that case.
Yeah, and they were monitored by different vendor equipment. But obviously, living in the same area, they were both homeless, both kind of tented up together. And they had been associating for some time prior. Now, technically, there's no reason we can't share that information, but this information currently resides in, you know, individual jurisdictions databases, mm-hmm. individual vendor databases. And so part of the effort in developing this IAPD, this information sharing mechanism, is to allow or facilitate better sharing of information. Again, it's not the answer, but if we have a better way to share information, then we can even more readily make some of these connections, and someone can say, why are these two offenders associating for so long, regardless of who's supervising them and
now,
regardless of
also,
what vendor.
This point of working on an automated analysis, if you talk to parole and probation people throughout the country, they will tell you that GPS is really a tremendous amount of difficult work in terms of sifting through all of that data and analyzing all of that data. What does it mean? So working on an automated analysis system, what is that?
Well, basically, yeah, as you say, the point is well taken. GPS is a tremendous tool, but it provides an overload of information for most agencies, too much information. And so there are techniques, there are tools that have been developed to help officers figure out what's important and what's not. One is a National Institute of Justice-funded effort through the University of Oklahoma to develop a toolkit to help officers identify patterns of movement within their offender population that are of interest. A lot of agencies across the country are required to review location points of their offenders on a daily basis, I mean, literally point by point by point. Part of the goal of this study from Oklahoma was to develop a toolkit that would allow an officer to approve a pattern of behavior, so a daily record of location points, and then store that approval. And so the next time or the next day, if the offender has the same general pattern, there's no need to review those points.
Mm-hmm.
However, if there's a divergence in that pattern, then the officer is alerted to that divergence, and they can look further into why, you know, what divergence occurred, when did it occur, where did the offender go, and use that as a starting point for gathering more information.
Really interesting, really interesting. The potential for predictive analysis, that all falls into that in terms of what you just said.
It's part and parcel. I think that, for some time, agencies have been looking into thinking about big data and data mining to help them make better decisions over the years. And I believe your agency has used GIS systems to better understand how the issue of place
mm-hmm.
it has a relevance and a context in offenders' lives,
mm-hmm.
you know, where they work, where they live. Are there services that are in those areas? Can they get to services? Is there public transportation, for example? Use of predictive analysis has not yet reached the point of dynamic inputs. So we have all this wealth of information about GPS. We have a lot of offenders on GPS. We have a lot of location points, not only in one jurisdiction, but across the nation, a lot of offenders. So is there a way to mine all of that data to make some determinations, to create some hypotheses about is there a pattern of movement that correlates to success on supervision? Is there a pattern of movement, behavior that correlates to failure? Are there dynamic factors that might tell you that a person is headed for failure or success?
Well, I think considering the amount of GPS being used currently and people interested in it and people looking at it, I think all of these are pretty pretty interesting developments and really fascinating. Before we get to the break, let's start with advances in drug and alcohol testing. Fingerprint analysis?
Yeah, this is an interesting approach. It was developed by a company in the UK, and basically what they're using is a portable way of measuring the secretions from fingerprints. So fingerprint oils, sweat that gets released through your fingerprint, they've developed technology that's able to analyze those secretions for drug use. So could provide a very non-invasive, easily used, low-cost alternative to your analysis.
Hmm. Through fingerprints.
Through fingerprints, yeah.
That's really interesting. Remote mobile breath analysis.
Yeah, this is an area that's gained a lot of traction in recent years. There are a number of different products that have just been introduced to the market, and the idea was to kind of provide a less intrusive, less costly alternative to the secure transdermal monitoring bracelets that are existing now that are on offenders' legs. These are basically handheld units that an offender was prompted to breathe into, and it takes an alcohol sample remotely. The technology confirms the identification of the offender either through photograph or facial recognition or breath print, depending on the technology. And it can note the offender's location point via built-in GPS chips.
Now, is this mobile breath analysis simply for alcohol or both drugs and alcohol?
Currently, it's just for alcohol.
Okay. And considering the alcohol problem that we have in terms of people under supervision, that's a fairly considerable advancement.
Oh, absolutely. Alcohol is a major contributor to crime, as you know, so it's a very important tool.
Facial thermo patterns. Tell me about that, and we'll go to the break.
Yeah, this was kind of interesting. And, you know, as we go through our research and finding emerging technologies, this one crossed our desk. Basically, it's a development in alcohol testing that came from researchers in Greece. They've looked into thermal imaging as a way to determine whether a person is inebriated or not. So basically, they've taken heat maps of people's faces, people who are sober and people who are inebriated, and they're able to tell through different algorithms what the characteristics of an inebriated person are. For example, they've determined that a person who is drunk, their nose tends to be much warmer than their forehead. And they can tell this through the thermal imaging.
Well, I can think of about 1,000 bars that probably could use that equipment. Joe, let me quickly reintroduce you. Ladies and gentlemen, we were talking today to Joe Russo. The show is on community corrections technology. Joe is with the University of Denver. He's currently the director of Corrections Technology Center of Excellence, a program within the National Law Enforcement and Corrections Technology Center system. Joe, go ahead and continue. Like I said, I can think of not 1,000, but probably 100,000 bars that need facial thermo patterns technology in that bar to tell whether or not they're drunk or not.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty innovative approach. And obviously, if you can make a determination about intoxication from a distance, perhaps, and that provides greater advantages. And there's no telling as this technology develops whether this can be deployed at a short distance or a longer distance to determine, inebriation patterns among crowds. For example, after a sporting event, it might help law enforcement agencies kind of focus on potentially problematic groups. So really, it has a lot of potential.
How would you employ it?
I didn't see anything in the material that talked about how this was structured. I assume it's a thermal imaging camera, mm-hmm. But with a telescopic type lens, maybe this could really work from a wide distance. Certainly, in a community corrections application, it would just be a camera in front of a person. You can get a reading very quickly.
Mm.
So we'll be keeping an eye on that technology.
Now, the holy grail here is, I would imagine, remote, because what we're talking about in many ways is not only dealing with technology that tells either through the fingerprints or facial thermo patterns, but remote devices, specifically on GPS and satellite tracking devices, that could tell whether or not a person is using alcohol or is inebriated. Does any of this apply to substance abuse yet, as to whether or not people under supervision, whether or not you can instantly tell they're using drugs remotely?
Yeah, there have been some companies who have delved into that area. I don't think that they're mature as yet. But as you mentioned, that is the holy grail. That's sort of the next horizon. We've kind of conquered that for alcohol use, and substance use is kind of the next level. And really, beyond that, I know that the practitioner groups that we talk to are going beyond illegal drugs, but they're interested in monitoring prescription drug use.
Mm-hmm.
Both for abuse, using too much, or not using enough. Because, particularly with mental health clients, if they're not on their medication,
oh,
that causes a whole myriad of problems that could easily be avoided. So one of the kind of the futuristic thinking approaches that we've been looking at is, how do we develop tools that remotely monitor prescription drug use, again, levels, to make sure that they're taking the appropriate amount, and we can avoid, you know, unfortunate situations later.
And the same sort of conundrum that we currently have today in terms of synthetic drugs, where the combinations change from time to time. I mean, it would be nice to have remote devices or new devices to deal with that issue as well, because we could be testing for cocaine, we could be testing for marijuana, we could be testing for opiates, but we, you know, testing for synthetic drugs, again, when the drugs constantly change, having some sort of new devices coming in, and especially mobile devices, that would be an extraordinarily interesting development.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, the industry, drug testing industry, is coming up with tests as quickly as they can. Obviously, new tests are very research development and intensive, so the costs of these tests tend to be very high. But when the target keeps moving, I don't know the answer to that. How do you develop tests fast enough to detect these ever-changing compounds?
All right. I find this interesting. Leveraging video teleconferencing, people under supervision reporting in via teleconference, and also the treatment and service delivery via teleconference. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, we've seen this more and more in rural or remote settings. Agencies are exploring ways to more efficiently and effectively connect with their clients. There are many parts of the country where clients live miles and miles away from probation offices, and it's obviously becomes a very resource-intensive proposition for officers to spend hours of time traveling to see one client. Compounding that, you know, if they live in remote areas, there are typically no services available for them to capitalize on. So agencies across the country are looking at video teleconferencing services to try and bridge this gap. There's one agency in rural Kansas that serves a 6-county area, and rather than driving, you know, miles and miles every day, they're trying to use Skype to connect with their clients and do reporting in that way.
So we're talking about, in terms of video, we're talking about using their smartphones, using their tablets?
Yeah, tablets, home computers, as long as they have internet connectivity, then they can, you know, they can connect with their probation officer via Skype or another service.
And the same questions that probation or parole agent would ask the person in directly when they see them could be asked in terms of the provision of treatment and service delivery. I mean, in terms of our own mental health caseload, one of the principal questions we ask is, are you taking your medications? Show me your medications. Are you taking them every day? Are you taking them as prescribed? So I would imagine that would enter into it.
Yeah, you can go through very much the same protocol that you would in an in-person interview. I would imagine the only thing that might be lacking is that direct in-person kind of look for effect and things that just would not translate very well via video. But for the most part, you know, the interview protocol would remain the same.
So, but the treatment part of it, are we talking about providing treatment services via teleconference?
Well, we've learned that Nebraska Judicial Services is using it in exactly that way. Again, they have a very remote rural section of their state, and rather than having offenders, again, drive miles to a central location to get services, they've set up video conferencing systems in the county sheriff's departments, and offenders can just go to their local sheriff's department, and there's a video set up there for them to take management classes, parenting, cognitive skills therapy.
Oh, that's exciting.
So it's interactive and it's cost effective, and you know, it's a very innovative approach to a difficult problem.
And I had a recent discussion this weekend with somebody who is, and I shouldn't identify the group at this stage of the game because they're just developing it, but they're talking about remote classes for correctional institutions. So all of this is really exciting. The last two issues in terms of the program, officer safety developments and a social media issue paper that was developed with the American Probation and Parole Association. Tell me about those.
So officer safety, we've come across two interesting items. One is the use of GPS technology for lone workers. These are workers who are out in remote settings by themselves and where safety could become an issue. These systems are deployed in industry, you know, across the spectrum. Minnesota Department of Corrections has recently explored using this for their parole agents who work out in the field by themselves. These are typically GPS tracking devices, as you would think of them on an offender, but the officer carries them. They have a man-down function, a duress alert, where the officer can communicate back with a central monitoring station. And the officer is tracked and located throughout, you know, their travels out there in the wilds. Communications are achieved either through cellular, the network. If that's not available, the technology can communicate via satellite communication so that the officer is never truly alone out there.
But that's fascinating because it could apply to urban environments as well.
Any environment, exactly, particularly where officers are working by themselves. It's a critical concern.
And I really like the fact that it has a man-down concept to it. So if a person goes into a prone position, there is an immediate alert sent to a central monitoring station.
Exactly. And the other neat officer safety tool that we came across, and this might be a little futuristic, but we've heard a presentation from researchers at MIT who developed clothing that can be used as a personal protective device. Basically, they embed electronics into a jacket or outer garment that conducts electricity and energy. So the wearer is insulated, but if they activate their jacket, for example, and an aggressor touches them, they receive a shock.
Amazing.
And the idea is to provide the officer enough space and time to get out of a hand-to-hand combat type situation. So again, for people working in the field alone, officers who don't carry firearms, this might be an interesting thing to consider in the future.
Final issue, and we only have a couple minutes left, social media. Again, you're working on in a paper with the American Probation and Parole Association about social media use. I see dozens of examples almost daily of people, not just under supervision, but criminals or people of interest, going out and sitting in front of doing a YouTube video, sitting in front of a stash of drugs and guns and talking about their exploits. This is becoming rather common.
There's no doubt. Social media is well established as a part of our lives in this day and age, whether we like it or not, particularly with the younger generation. So many of our offenders have this virtual presence. They maintain presence on social media. And, you know, to some extent, it's irresponsible for community corrections agencies not to explore, you know, and look at how offenders are using social media because it is such an ingrained part of life. So this issue paper that we're developing is designed to help agencies understand what social media is, why it's important, what offenders are doing online, again, why it's important to monitor that activity, and some issues that they need to consider as they develop a policy about how their officers should use social media. There are some pitfalls about social media, privacy issues, how to authenticate information that they may obtain via Facebook pages, for example, of their offenders, whether to do covert investigations, for example, where the officer might pretend to be someone else, establish a false identity. All of these are issues that agencies need to consider strongly, compare them to their missions and their goals, and really develop policies so that when officers do engage in this activity, it's in direct alignment with the agency's mission.
We were talking before the program about being able to geocode or all photos if you have GPS enabled on your phone or tablet. Evidently, the photos are geocoded, so we can figure out not only what he was doing because he's making a YouTube video, and I mean there are all sorts of other examples, but YouTube certainly does come to mind, but also figuring out exactly where he is.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a little known feature, and if you use a digital camera with location systems enabled, you could very well be giving up your location, which, of course, works very well in the favor of probation and parole officers who are trying to determine if their offender is outside of jurisdiction.
In the final 30 seconds or so, the bottom line behind all of the technology that we talked about today, Joe, is to ensure compliant behavior, is to keep people out of the prison system, is to prompt their good behavior, reduce technical violations, reduce rearrest, and reduce return to prison. So this has a fiscal note to it that could be very favorable to state and local agencies, and it has research behind it that in essence says that people, when they're monitored in these ways, are far more compliant and they are just doing much better on parole and probation supervision, correct or incorrect?
Exactly. It's all about outcomes. Technology is a tool, and we have to be careful not to overuse it and over-supervise low-risk offenders. Ideally, we're using the appropriate level of technology to supervise offenders and dedicate more of officers' valuable time on those high-risk cases that demand that interpersonal connection.
And I'm really glad you brought that up, because the real focus of most of this would be the high-risk offender.
Exactly. It's very easy to fall into a trap of applying technology across the board, but we have to, you know, really be more intelligent about how to use our limited resources.
Well, Joe, as always, I really do appreciate you coming onto the show today. And ladies and gentlemen, we did a show with Joe Russo on community corrections technology. I always find it fascinating. We did discuss satellite tracking and alcohol and drug testing and teleconferencing and social media and lots of other things. Joe is with the University of Denver and currently serves as the Director of Corrections Technology Center of Excellence program within the National Law Enforcement and Corrections Technology Center system. Ladies and gentlemen, this is DC Public Safety. We appreciate your comments. We even appreciate your criticisms, and please have yourselves a very pleasant day.